Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we are wrapping up our third week-long series on California's water crisis by talking about media coverage of the crisis. The drought is receiving international attention. So what strikes you about the way the crisis is being covered and framed? A new website focusing solely on the drought recently launched. Laura Satrakian, the founder of News Deeply, has launched the site Water Deeply. Matt Weiser, the site's first hire, says the Water Deeply staff hope to help people understand how we got here. While weather is definitely a factor, the way the state manages water and makes decisions, really, we need to look at that for where we are now. Matt Weiser is managing editor of Water Deeply, and he's former water and environmental reporter with McClatchy's Sacramento Bee. His latest piece for Water Deeply focuses on the drought's effect on wildlife. He reports that starvation, disease, and extinction are among the risks as another hot, dry summer begins. And Matt joins us from... Hi, Matt. Where are you?
I'm in Washington, D.C.
Washington.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Congrats on the site. It's an amazing website. And I'm really glad that this launched because I think we really need something like this. So thanks for joining us. We're also joined by Nathan Halverson, reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting and Reveal News. Nathan's recent piece is called California's Homes Are Sinking and Cracking. He also has a piece called California is Sinking. And he takes a look at the fact that California is sinking, and it's sinking fast. He reports that while the state's drought-induced sinking is well known, new details highlight just how severe it's become and how little the government has done to monitor it. Last summer, scientists recorded the worst sinking in at least 50 years. This summer, all-time records are expected across the state as thousands of miles of land in the Central Valley and elsewhere sink. And Nathan joins me in studio. Hi, Nathan. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Nathan Halverson with the Center for Investigative Reporting, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, the New Yorker had a piece out this week called The Really Big One on the Cascadia Subduction Zone by Catherine Schultz that took a look at a fault line that runs basically from Northern California up to the southern border with Canada that has the potential of unleashing a major earthquake, and sort of the lack of preparedness by local governments and others through that region in dealing with what could be a devastating earthquake. Again, just kind of highlighting and bringing awareness to areas that we need to engineer our way out of sort of looming problems.
I saw that posted at least 25 times on Facebook. It's getting a lot of attention, but I haven't read it yet. So what is the overall takeaway? Because it looked kind of frightening just based on the headline and the first sentence that I read.
Yeah, it's frightening. I mean, the overall takeaway is that there is a major fault line that runs along the stretch of the Northwest. And if it has a full rupture along the entire fault line, it has the potential of producing an earthquake larger than a 9.0, creating both a tsunami and, you know, shaking that could last 3 or 4 minutes.
Wow.
And create a huge amount of damage, and that largely the jurisdictions that fall within the governmental jurisdictions that fall within that area aren't prepared to deal with the devastation that it would unleash, and that it could happen well within this century.
So kudos to Catherine Schultz of The New Yorker. The piece is The Really Big One. She writes, an earthquake will destroy a sizable portion of the coastal Northwest. The question is when? And we'll put a link to that article at yourcallradio.org. That's Nathan Halverson. He's a reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. And what about you, Matt? Matt Weiser is managing editor of Water Deeply. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, there's two things, I guess. One is a piece out, I think it came out yesterday on National Geographic website, by a reporter who's well-known in the Bay Area, Jane Kay. She used to work for the San Francisco Chronicle. Terrific environmental reporter. She did a piece for National Geographic about, again, about the drought's effect on wildlife, particularly migratory birds, and how they're going to find less habitat and food this year as they travel the Pacific Flyway. And then another one is kind of a different angle on the drought. It's a video that was done by High Country News about how declining groundwater levels in the Central Valley are also harming water quality. And the video was just very well done, very professional, and also very informative about a very complicated subject.
All right. Well, thank you for both of those. And we will add links at our website, yourcallradio.org. That is Matt Weiser, managing editor of Water Deeply. And today we are talking about media coverage of the water crisis in California. If you missed any of our shows this week, we talked about the meat and dairy industries yesterday. We talked about a number of topics starting on Monday. You can find that at yourcallradio.org. And Matt, I was really excited to hear about Water Deeply. And it's an amazing website, really extensive. So there's original reporting there. And then there's also reporting from other websites. Talk a little bit about the site. What is the overall goal of Water Deeply? And it's at waterdeeply.org.
As I see it, the overall goal is to kind of help people understand how we got into this drought and how we might get out of it, what some of the solutions might be. In other words, to bring a lot more context to the subject than people might be used to seeing in the news. And it's not an easy thing to do in a lot of news coverage because water issues are very complex. And the drought itself is very complex, partly because California is a complicated state and the effects vary depending on where you are and what your water source is and a bunch of other factors. So the idea is to help people have a broader, more comprehensive understanding of how we got here and what some of the solutions might be.
And so Water Deeply has partnered with a number of news websites, right? McClatchy and the AP. And I'm looking at the website right now, and it's just such a wealth, has such a wealth of information. There are links to other stories, radio stories, news articles, op-eds. There's a video, how the California drought exacerbates water contamination, for example. And so, Matt, you were hired to be the managing editor. How much original reporting is going to be at Water Deeply?
Well, it's going to be a mix of kind of carefully curated aggregating from other sites and original reporting. I'm doing reporting myself on there. We have a part-timer who's doing some original reporting, and we're also going to be working with freelancers to do stories for us, too. So, honestly, it's a little too soon to say what the exact mix is going to be, but I think it's safe to say it'll be at least 50% original reporting. At least that's our goal right now.
And right now it's a year-long project, and then you'll find out if you'll continue it. How does that work?
Well, this is the third site that has been launched by News Deeply. The two others deal with the conflict in Syria and the Ebola virus. And the idea in all these cases is to kind of make it a short-term, deep examination of a particular subject. So the goal with Water Deeply is to do this for a year and then see where we're at. There is possibility that we would expand the concept to cover the West and the drought and water scarcity issues that are going on throughout the West, but we will be making that call later on.
And Matt Weiser is managing editor of the news site Water Deeply. I hope you can check it out, waterdeeply.org. And Nathan Halverson is a reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. Nathan, you've done really great reporting on California sinking. You've covered water issues and the drought and then the food system, which, as we have been talking about on our shows about our diets, it's such a globalized food system now. How is the Center for Investigative Reporting tackling the water crisis in California?
Well, yeah, we've pulled some of our reporters to look specifically at the drought. We have a team now of four or five of us that are kind of focused on environmental issues. My background is really really in business, economics, and finance. But I think that plays well into sort of some of the realities that we look at when we're looking at issues around water. And so we've done a variety of stories. One of my colleagues, also a former Sacramento Bee reporter, reported that the water we're pumping up from the ground in California now had seeped under there 20,000 years ago. We're drilling so deeply that we're drilling up 20,000-year-old water. So we're really taking a wide and deep look, and I think the idea here is to help raise public awareness of the issue beyond just this drought, but of sort of the larger issues around freshwater scarcity, the looming issues around freshwater scarcity around the world, and how, you know, people can begin thinking about it constructively to help engineer our way out of this problem.
So what are your overall thoughts about how this massive, massive issue has been covered by the media? There was an interesting piece in These Times called Why Corporate Media Want to Blame California's Drought on Your Eating Avocados. It says the New York Times is wrong. Consumers eating grapes and mandarin oranges are not the ones really guilty of contributing to California's water shortage. And we saw there was about a month where a ton of outlets were focusing on almonds and the drought. That's kind of dissipated, but it's just interesting to see what angles reporters take.
Right. And there's been a lot of reporting on the drought. I think to the public's credit, they have a huge appetite for understanding this issue. I think in part because it directly impacts all of us. So we're all really curious about it, but also just the recognition that it's probably an issue that extends beyond the drought, existed prior to the drought, and is something that we're going to have to solve for long term. I think the coverage around, you know, what we eat and its impact is really apropos to the conversation. I think we all need to be more conscientious consumers. I think that by understanding when you look at climate change and you look at things like looming freshwater issues, they're so massive that they can really make all of us just kind of want to bury our heads under the sand and say, well, what can I do? I can't do anything about that. That's way too huge for me as just an individual to tackle. But when we empower people and say to them, well, there are choices, it's not just taking a shorter shower, but it's also choosing what you eat and being a conscientious consumer in that regard, we empower people to make decisions that can help us all engineer our way out of this problem. And so I think looking at the almond industry and the pistachio industry and the way that the media covered it initially was germane. I think, though, we have to understand that growing almonds and pistachios in the San Joaquin Valley, which is essentially a desert, is much different than growing almonds or pistachios in the northern part of the Central Valley, which receives more precipitation. And then you're looking at the San Joaquin Valley, you have to say, okay, so where are they getting their water from to grow these thirsty crops? What are they going to do with these thirsty crops in drought years? And in looking at it a little bit more in a sophisticated way like that, we're able to make better, you know, informing people in that regard. We're empowering people to make better decisions as consumers.
Matt, what is your take? I appreciated what you've said recently about the goals of Water Deeply, that you hope to help people understand how we got here. The way that the state manages water and decisions that were made set us up for where we are now. And this piece at In These Times says that the corporate media tends to frame these issues as social and environmental problems as a matter of personal virtue or guilt. So it's like if you're eating too much of this, you're a bad person. If you can take a shorter shower, you're a good person. And a lot of these articles fail to really go a little deeper and look at the policies that have got us here in the first place.
Yeah, I guess I would agree with that. And one of the things I hope to do with our coverage at Water Deeply is to help people understand that in California, what we're facing is a fundamental problem of scarcity. And it's been brought to everyone's attention by the drought, but it's a situation that exists really no matter what the weather is. I mean, even in normal water years, we have problems with scarcity. It's just that most people don't feel it because it's affecting the environment, for example, or it's affecting particular kinds of habitat that people don't think about a lot, such as forest health. These things are happening in part because there isn't enough water to serve all the needs in California, and by that I mean people as well as the environment that we all enjoy so much in California. So what I hope is that collectively as the media, we can help people understand that this is a long-term problem and we have to figure out how to share this resource in a state of 38 million people.
Matt Weiser is managing editor of Water Deeply. It is a new website that recently launched under the umbrella of News Deeply. He's a former water and environmental reporter with McClatchy Sacramento Bee. Nathan Halverson is a reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting and Reveal News. You can find their latest pieces at yourcallradio.org. Today we're wrapping up our third week-long series on California's water crisis. By talking about media coverage, what really strikes you about what you've read? This is now getting international attention. How do you think the media are really framing the issue? Do you feel like they're going deep to look at the history behind the policies that really got us here? And what about solutions? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Also, how do you think the media are focusing on individual use versus agriculture? What are your thoughts on that? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Nathan, let's talk a little bit about the piece you wrote, California is Sinking and It's Getting Worse. You report that last summer, scientists recorded the worst sinking in at least 50 years. This summer, all-time records are expected across the state as thousands of miles of land in the Central Valley and elsewhere sink. But the extent of the problem and how much it will cost taxpayers to fix are part of the mystery of the state's unfolding drought, because no agency is tracking the sinking statewide. How is this possible?
Well, historically we had really bad sinking in California in the late 60s, and the state government and the federal government found ways to engineer around that problem by bringing in water from the north and delivering it down to the southern farmers. And they really thought they had this issue of subsidence or the land sinking solved by the 1970s. So they looked away. They began focusing on other problems. And it wasn't until a few years ago when a sort of entrepreneurial scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey, she went out and she found areas that were sinking quite radically. And they began looking more deeply at the issue. And the Department of Water Resources still has about 350 monitors out across the state that do monitor and measure the sinking, but that's to cover tens of thousands of miles, and this sinking can be fairly focused into a specific region. So one of the fastest sinking areas that we know about in the state is a region in the San Joaquin Valley called El Nido. And the last time anyone looked at how fast it was sinking was back in 2012, and that was about 1 foot per year.
Wow. That's huge.
Yeah, it can really gum up the infrastructure in that region, from, you know, homeowners seeing cracking in their homes to bridges that are slowly sinking below water level lines to highways that are buckling and cracking.
And so this is happening because farmers are taking water out of the ground. And we had a reporter on, her name escapes me, from the Sacramento Bee about 2 months ago, and she had an amazing video that really helps you visualize what's happening. And so the wells that are being dug into the ground in some cases are as high as the Empire State Building, right? So that goes very, very deep into the ground, and it's sucking up all of that water, and that's why the land is sinking.
Yeah, farmers in that region have had to sink their wells extraordinarily deep, 1,000 or more feet, because the groundwater in that area is at historic lows, all-time lows. And that's what triggers the sinking, is that you now have these buried clay formations called aquitards. And as the groundwater is lowered below these clay deposits, they begin leaching out their water and begin compacting. And eventually that rises up to the surface. Now, that doesn't happen, obviously, instantaneously, because we're talking about a huge amount of land. So even when the groundwater levels come back up, when the rain returns, we're likely to continue to see some amount of sinking for years. And one geologist told me possibly decades.
Wow. You did report that in the 1960s, some repairs had to be made, and it wasn't cheap even back then.
Right. The California Water Foundation did an excellent report that I think came out last year, largely written by hydrologists and other scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey, that found the extent of the damage that the state incurred in the late 60s and into 70s reached over $1 billion as it fixed canals and highways and other infrastructure. And that was just a partial estimate. A lot of the damages just go unaccounted for.
So are any state officials looking at this? Because as you report, two bridges in Fresno County, for example, have sunk so much that they are nearly underwater. It'll cost millions to rebuild. Nearby, an elementary school is slowly descending into a mile-long sinkhole that will make it susceptible to future flooding.
Yeah. Well, one of the federal scientists pointed out to me that they had been trying to get the attention of state officials and state agencies with no luck. So I did. I called and contacted Caltrans and asked them if they were seeing issues with subsidence or the sinking, and they said no, that they weren't aware of any areas where they were having issues with it. And then I found reports of these bridges sinking. So it's not that they're not aware that there is damage taking place. It's that no one is making the connection to the underground aquifer depletion and the taxpayer costs. And so what ends up happening is the taxpayers, in effect, are subsidizing the water for the farmers or the municipalities that are drawing it out of the ground, because we are having to pay for the damages. So we're on the hook. And so, in effect, whether it's almonds being shipped out of state or food that we're eating, we're all paying for that in a very roundabout way.
Matt, you've been reporting on these issues for a while now. What are your thoughts about California sinking and the fact that government officials are not keeping track of this?
Well, one of the important areas to discuss on this is groundwater regulation. And until recently, it was virtually non-existent in California. For many, many years, if you owned a piece of property, you could drill a well on it and pump out all the groundwater you wanted and not have to report to anyone how much you were pumping or what you were using it for, even if it began to take groundwater from your neighbor. Last year, I believe, the legislature passed a set of laws that begins to regulate groundwater pumping. People who own wells and agencies that operate wells are going to have to start reporting how much they draw from the ground. But due to some political compromises, they won't have to start reporting this for about 25 years. And what we're seeing in the meantime is a major rush to drill more wells. There's been reports recently about companies in Texas, for example, that manufacture and lease well drilling equipment. They're unable to keep up with demand for well drilling rigs to service California. Huh. And so as a result, until this law takes full effect, we're going to see lots more depletion of groundwater. And it won't be the water that's being taken out during this drought, it won't be replaced next winter, even if we have a wet El Nino. It won't be replaced in five winters. It'll take many, many years to replenish that groundwater if it ever happens. As Nathan pointed out, a lot of this groundwater accumulated over tens of thousands of years, so it's likely we'll see permanent scarcity in a lot of these aquifers.
Well, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about groundwater. Again, farmers will not be required to meet goals until 2040 at the earliest. Nathan reports that information will then be kept private, and I'd love to talk to you about that right after the break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
There's lots of ways to join in today's conversation on Your Call. You can send your email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org if you'd like to join us live on the air and talk to one of our guests and Rose Aguilar. The toll-free number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Coming up at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say, and at noon today, it's the Tavis Smiley Show.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with Anna Deavere Smith about her new one-woman show, Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education, the California chapter. It's playing now at the Berkeley Rep. Anna Deavere Smith performs portraits from 150 interviews she conducted with judges, prisoners, students, and teachers. And then she invites the audience to engage one another and become agents of change. With so much talk about prison reform, what will it take to end the school-to-prison pipeline? That is on Monday. On Tuesday, we'll have a conversation about an amazing and sobering documentary called 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. The film observes scenes of Jordan Davis's parents, Ron and Lucy, as they go to the courtroom to seek justice for their son, who was killed in 2012 when he and three friends pulled up into a gas station parking lot in Florida. They had loud music on. A white man pulled up next to them, told them to turn it down. After they exchanged words, the man shot and killed Jordan Davis. He put 10 bullets in the moving car. And so this film follows the story of this family and their quest for justice. That's on Tuesday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are wrapping up our third week-long series on California's water crisis by talking about media coverage of the crisis. We're joined by Matt Weiser, managing editor of Water Deeply. It's a new site under the News Deeply umbrella. He's a former water and environmental reporter with McClatchy Sacramento Bee. Nathan Halverson is a reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting and Reveal News. And we're talking about Nathan's reporting on California sinking, literally. And before the break, we were talking about the fact that this is happening because farmers are taking water out of the ground. These new groundwater rules require farmers to report the water that they're taking, and they have to meet those goals by 2040. Now, we've done a bunch of shows on this, Nathan, and no one on these shows has said that this information on who's pumping what will be kept private. So the public won't have access to this information?
Yeah, and this is a bit of fine reporting that my colleagues at Reveal did, where they dug deep into the laws that were passed last year that will eventually put in place the first regulations on pumping groundwater in California. As Matt pointed out, though, the teeth of that law doesn't come into effect until, well, for another 25 years. And they dug into that law and found that the state will not release information on who is pumping how much, which becomes an issue when we're wanting to look at people who are potentially overusing a resource. And so without that ability to sort of parse publicly, I think personally as a journalist, obviously I mean, with a bit of bias, we lose a bit of our ability to monitor and report to the public what's going on.
So the state is going to have access to this information, and that's it.
That's my understanding, yeah.
And then, Matt, the state will then do what with it? I mean, without public pressure, it seems like the state doesn't have to do much with it unless there's a lot of... what goes on behind the scenes once the government gets this information?
Well, the law requires the state to ensure that groundwater is maintained at a quote-unquote sustainable level. And maybe Nathan can elaborate on what that means, but my understanding is that it means that it's not being depleted below a certain baseline level that's also set in the law. So the state will be policing this using the reports submitted by well owners, and we're all supposed to trust that the state is going to do that job well. And we have really no way to check and verify that because the records aren't public.
And so at this point, there's absolutely no way of knowing what this groundwater is being used for?
That's correct. Yeah. A well owner can do whatever they want with their well water. There is some legal debate at the moment about whether the State Water Resources Control Board has the power to use existing laws to ensure that well water is being put to a reasonable use, and reasonable is the legal term. But it remains to be seen if the State Water Board is going to go after well owners, largely because at the moment they have their hands completely full regulating surface water. They don't have the staff to police all of the water rights curtailments they've already imposed. So their ability to enforce those restrictions is very much in question.
Well, I hope you can check out the story, California is Sinking and It Gets Worse, by today's guest, Nathan Halverson. We've got a number of callers on the line, so let's go to Gabriel in Santa Cruz. Hi, Gabriel. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm actually parked on the cliffs above the city of Capitola here in the Monterey Bay, and it just happens, ironically, that I'm looking straight across to the Moss Landing Power Plant, which is a natural gas-powered plant that serves most of the Monterey Bay. And my question to your guests is, with the new acquired technology for fracking, which apparently uses quite a bit of water and creates quite a bit of contaminated water as a part of the process, if they can speak to how this fracking practice might affect the drought here in California.
All right. Thank you for that. Reuters reported in April that California oil producers used 70 million gallons of water in the process of fracking for oil and gas in the state last year. And have either of you reported on fracking and water? Nathan, you haven't?
I haven't done so myself, no.
What are your thoughts about the coverage that we're seeing?
I've read some of the coverage. Frankly, the question regarding fracking and water use comes up frequently in the comments under my stories and in calls I've heard into shows. But from what I've seen, the actual use of water for fracking is a fairly small percentage of the state's overall use. And so, well, we need to, I think, tighten our belt in all across the board to tackle this issue. It seems to be a fairly small slice of the overall pie.
Because previous estimates said it was about 100 million gallons. And again, Reuters is reporting that it's about 70 million a year. So if you say that's a small percentage, when we look at California, what are the high users? I mean, we've got agriculture at 80%. And there's ways to look at that. Yesterday, we talked about meat and dairy, which, according to the Water Footprint Network, uses 47% of the state's water. So based on your reporting, what industries are using the most water?
Yeah, I mean, agriculture is by far using the most water. But I think this is also a good time to make sure we're not castigating farmers, right? I mean, these are the people that are out there, and even large agribusinesses, these are the folks that are out there that are feeding the world. Their efforts are feeding not just people in California, not just people in this country, but people across the world. And that keeps food prices down. And when food prices are kept down, starvation rates in Africa are kept down. So we have to keep in mind that we're looking at a very large system, and that when we're talking about fresh water in California, we almost now, because of how connected the globe is, we have to start pulling back and thinking, how are we using fresh water supplies around the world? And when we do that, it actually gets a little bit scarier, because we're seeing, NASA came out with a report a couple weeks ago that showed aquifers, I think it was 21 of the world's 37 major aquifers, are being rapidly depleted. And this is a major engineering problem that we're going to have to tackle if we want to keep food prices down and starvation rates continuing to decline.
Well, so if you get beyond castigating, what about asking the tough questions like, should California be the number one dairy state in the country? Should California be planting alfalfa with water from the Colorado River and then sending it to Asia and the Middle East? Do you think the media are really asking those questions?
I think so. I do. I think I've seen a lot of coverage asking, and I think what you're specifically talking about now is land use. Where is it appropriate to grow certain crops? And also, I think putting pressure on farmers is appropriate. I mean, if you look at farmers in Israel and other water-type markets, they have put in place expensive but in the long term cost-beneficial equipment to be more effective with their water use. So like we're asking people in their homes to be more conscientious about their water use, we can can be applying, I think, that same pressure across the board, including the 80% of water that's going to farmers.
Yeah, Matt, what are your thoughts? How do you see that playing out in the media? Doing these series, it's so interesting that there's so much focus on individual use. And then when you hear about oil producers or fracking or the fact that the dairy industry uses 9 billion gallons of water a day, how do you think the media are focusing on those issues and asking those tough questions?
Well, I agree with Nathan. I think it's appropriate to ask those questions, but I think it's more appropriate to ask, what can we do about it? For instance, for years, I would ask California policymakers, should we consider some kind of regulation that tells farmers what they can grow on their land depending on the microclimate, depending on what their access to water is? And, that kind of question is sort of like a third rail in California and in America, because we're a capitalist economy and no one in a position of making policy wants to think about telling anyone what they can or cannot grow. And it may just be impossible in the culture and the economy that we have. But I think one thing that is available to everyone is to think about the choices they make in their diet, in their daily habits. All of these things feed into how much water we consume in California. So that is a way to address the issue. And just real quick on the subject of fracking, to put that 70 million gallons number that you mentioned in perspective, that's equivalent to about 210 acre feet. And if you think about how much water that is in the grand scheme of things, it's really not very much. Folsom Reservoir in Sacramento, for example, holds 1 million acre feet. Jasper Reservoir, the biggest in the state, holds about 5 million acre feet. So I don't want to diminish the concern about fracking. There's certainly a lot of serious issues there, but in the larger game, 200 acre feet of water is not going to change our experience of drought in California.
Well, thank you for calling in, Gabriel, and we will continue our coverage of fracking. Thanks for calling. Let's go next to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi. This is David in San Francisco. One thing people can do is support KLW, and kudos on a Friday to you, Rose, for the third week-long series on water drought, and I hope there's a fourth.
Thank you. There will be.
Yeah. Yesterday, Chris Hayes is continuing with a week-long study or investigation on MSNBC of the California water crisis. He talked with Nestle's water bottling plant and also the head of the California Water Resources Board. It was very unsatisfying to hear Nestle's spokesperson talking about why they were able to bring water out. And also, I thought one thing that was really interesting that I heard this week was one-fifth of all California water resources are contaminated with things like arsenic, uranium. And then also the Board of Supervisors are looking at, in this California drought, urban issues like our forests, like Mount Sutro and other things that may be in danger and not equipped to handle things like a fire. Another thing people can do is go one day without eating meat. That will make an enormous impact. Thank you, Rose.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, David. We did a whole show on the bottled water industry, and you can search for it at yourcallradio.org. We've also done two shows on our diets, What If We Ate As If Water Mattered. Yesterday, we talked about the meat and dairy industries. Nathan, we were talking about this before the show. What are your thoughts on that, on cutting back on meat and dairy, considering they use so much water?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good idea. I mean, I eat meat. I love meat. I would butcher a pig and turn its belly into bacon. That said, there doesn't seem to be much that people can do as individuals better to improve their own health, reduce impacts on global warming and the environment, reduce food prices and therefore help reduce world starvation and lower their water consumption, than eat less meat. It's a very effective way for people to make a very direct decision that's going to have a global impact. And it empowers people knowing that. And so I do think that's an important piece of information to put out there, that eating more conscientiously, in fact, is empowering for consumers.
Matt, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I completely agree. These are tough choices for people because no one likes to give up things they enjoy. But when you start to consider the environmental effects of some of our food choices, they can be pretty severe. And that goes for the effect on water supplies also. And our, you know, a lot of people, you mentioned bottled water, a lot of people buy bottled water, and there's really no need for that. The tap water we all have in California is held to a higher standard than any of the bottled water you buy, and it's exponentially cheaper. So that's another big choice that people can make that will ease their wallets and may have a small effect on water availability during the drought.
And if I'm remembering my stats here correctly, I think Americans eat the second most meat per capita of any country in the world. I think only Australia eats more meat per capita. So we have a lot of room that we can give up in terms of our meat consumption, I think. You know, China right now eats about half as much meat as we do per capita. And that's rising as their middle class gets bigger. And, you know, I think The Guardian had a story out a year ago that says if China's meat consumption continues to increase and comes on par with our meat consumption here in the States, that alone will create enough greenhouse gases to basically push climate change beyond the reparable point.
Wow.
So I think as Americans, you know, we kind of, if you feel you have a global obligation, reducing your meat consumption is one of those things.
Abram Lustgarten with ProPublica wrote a great piece, California's Drought is Part of a Much Bigger Water Crisis. And he writes that research suggests that the country's meat industries create such a high demand for water-thirsty feed crops. If every American ate meat one less day a week, it could save as much water as flows through the Colorado River in an entire year. I mean, that's huge.
It's huge. And it has to do with water. But also keep in mind that right now in Nigeria, one in five families is reporting a foodless day. They're not giving up meat. They're giving up food because they can't afford it, because food prices have climbed. And one of the main reasons food prices have climbed is that it's very inefficient to grow crops to then feed to animals. And the world's middle class is getting bigger in China, in India. These are good things, but one of the unintended consequences of creating wealth in these countries is larger meat consumption, which then drives up the base commodities that people in Nigeria need to make bread. And so they're just having to choose one day on the calendar where they're not eating.
Wow.
And so it all ties in. And so beyond just reducing your water consumption, helping to keep food prices down for people that were born in areas without the ability to make an income to buy their food. It plays into a larger ideal.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up because that's rarely brought into these conversations. That's Nathan Halverson, reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting and Reveal News. And Matt Weiser is managing editor of the new website Water Deeply, which solely focuses on California's water crisis. He's former water and environmental reporter with McClatchy's Sacramento Bee. And Matt, I want to make sure that we give wildlife a voice before we end the show. You've got a sobering story, but really important piece about how the drought is affecting wildlife. You report that a long summer of wildlife problems is ahead in California as animals struggle to find food and habitat during the state's worst drought in history. Whether they travel by fin, feather, or paw, almost no species is immune. Tell us what you found out about black bears and just how hard it is for them to find food right now.
Yeah, the bear situation is kind of incredible. I spoke with a wildlife biologist who works for the state in Kern County down in the Southern Sierra, and they had a really enormous problem with bears down there last year, and they're expecting another similar situation this summer, they had more reports of problem bears in 6 months last year than they had in the prior 20 years. And there were eight incidents, if I remember the number right, there were eight incidents in which bears had to be trapped in the city of Bakersfield and relocated back to wild areas. If you know a little bit about Kern County, and I know a lot about it because I used to work for the newspaper down there, it takes a lot for a bear to get into Bakersfield from any place that they normally want to be. And that tells you that these bears are desperate for food and water, and they're willing to travel a long way to get it. There was one particularly alarming anecdote that this biologist told me about, which is there was a case where a mother bear and a cub somehow ended up inside the fences of a solar generating station in Boron in the Mojave Desert. And that is east of Ridgecrest. So somehow this mother and her cub crossed the Mojave Desert looking for food and water and got trapped inside this solar facility. So the state went out and darted these bears and relocated them back to the Sierras, which were approximately 70 miles away to the west, to put them back in their natural habitat. That's real desperation on the part of those bears right there. And one of the things that I was told that one of the limitations they're running into is that the law allows them to relocate bears only 75 miles from where they're found. And in cases like that, they may not be able to move them far enough to get them back into suitable habitat. So this drought is creating all kinds of wildlife conflicts like that. And one of the bears, just one more quick anecdote related to that, one of the bears captured in Bakersfield died after it was darted. And they couldn't figure out, they did a necropsy on it, and they couldn't figure out exactly why it died. But it's likely that it was, you know, just so hungry and in need of water that it didn't have much left to run on. Mm.
You also report on ducks, geese, and other waterfowl, and rice growers are not planting this year. They either don't have enough water or they've realized their water is more valuable than rice, and rice farmers flood their fields in the fall to decompose leftover rice straw, which is great for waterfowl, right? But because right. they're not growing, the waterfowl are forced to crowd together more densely on whatever habitat remains. Talk about how that stresses the hormones and that's really affecting waterfowl.
Right. Well, the more waterfowl are crowded together, the more stress hormones they emit. And if you think about when we're stressed, usually it elevates our heart rate and you consume more calories. So whatever you've just eaten gets used up faster, and you have to eat more the next time or eat sooner. And that's just what happens with birds, too. They start out with less food in the environment. They're crowded together in the last habitat that remains, and this drives up their need for even more food. The other thing that happens in that situation is that the more they're crowded together, the more likely it is that they'll pass illnesses like avian botulism or cholera because they're more densely packed together. And so these two diseases are normal in waterfowl, and birds die from them by the score every year. But because of the crowding, the excessive crowding that's likely this year and which happened last year, there are going to be more birds that die from these illnesses.
And then, briefly, we're almost out of time, but what about how this is affecting salmon?
Yeah, that's a whole other ball of wax. They're more directly affected by this drought than pretty much any other wildlife because they live in the rivers. And we're talking about salmon populations that are already in trouble because of the long-term water scarcity in California that I talked about earlier. We have built dams that block all the major rivers in California, and most of them were built without fish ladders. So these salmon cannot get into the cooler water that exists above the dams, which is their native habitat where they used to breed. So instead, they're stuck below the dams at lower elevations where the water is likely to get much hotter. And salmon can only withstand water up to about 56 degrees Fahrenheit. If it gets warmer than that, they start to get illnesses. And when it gets above 58 to 60 degrees, it's virtually a sure thing that they're going to die. And that's just what happened last year with the winter run Chinook salmon on the Sacramento River. That's an endangered species, and the water agencies thought they had held enough water back in Shasta Reservoir to keep the river cool for these fish, but they miscalculated, and something like 95% of that year's juvenile winter run died.
Mm.
And again, this is an endangered species. So this year they're trying again to save even more water to protect those fish so that they don't have a second year of these fish killed. Because if that were to happen, it would make it that much more likely that this species will go extinct. And that's just one example. There's many other examples of fish that are in trouble this year.
So sad. Matt, are you going to continue following this? You talked to people at the Department of Fish and Wildlife who said that they're going to track this and they're afraid that it's probably going to get worse.
Yeah, I will be tracking it. Absolutely, and lots of other media are paying attention to this also because it's because salmon are a charismatic species, and a lot of us enjoy eating salmon. These are the fish that are caught in the wild in the ocean that we buy at the farmer's market or in the grocery store. We're very blessed to have wild salmon runs in California that we can also eat. We'll be paying attention to this one very closely.
And I hope you can check out Matt's piece about how officials are very, very concerned about the drought's effect on wildlife. Matt Weiser is managing editor of the new website, Water Deeply. Nathan Halverson is a reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting and Reveal News. Nathan and Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What will it take to end the school-to-prison pipeline? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Anna DeVere Smith about her new one-woman show, Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education, the California chapter. It's playing now at the Berkeley Rep. Smith performs portraits from interviews she conducted with judges, prisoners, students, and teachers. She then invites the audience to become agents of change. With so much talk about prison reform, what will it take to see real change? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Knock Wynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.